Hey everybody, it's our test of going live, our test of going live for the Out to Coop Live call-in show. Going to begin in earnest in a couple minutes. This is kind of, I guess, the pre-show. So I'll give you a countdown of about 3, 2, 1 in a little bit to let you know when the show is officially started. I think I'm going to give it about 15 to 20 seconds. Just want to make sure everything's up and running, and then we'll be good to go. So here we go.
Signs of life. Please don't tell me that the human race did not survive.
There are no people in the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Hey everybody, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Thank you all for joining us for this first ever, I guess you call it actually a pre-launch show for a new feature for Out to Coop Podcast, Raging Chicken's Out to Coop Podcast, which will be a call-in show. Now, some of you may recall that we did an earlier version of the test, which was just completely random, last minute and that stuff. My daughter actually helped me set it up. But we're looking to make this a weekly feature. So in addition to our Friday podcast featuring Sean Kitchen, where we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics, the call-in show will be more thematically organized and will really be the kind of show which will allow people to call in to talk a little bit about the whatever issue that we're talking about that week. This week, I thought that a good place to begin would be with the back to school in the pandemic. And the reason why I thought we'd start with that was because it's freaking crazy. What the hell is going on out there? And there's, you know, Sean and I on a regular podcast have a weekly podcast on Friday. We always get into this tension, right? Because we're trying to cover so much that we can't really drill down into some specifics each week. And I know Sean tends to kind of have his eyes glaze over when I start talking about what's going on in the state system of higher education, when I talk about what's going on in public education in the state of Pennsylvania, or educational policy and that kind of stuff, because that's really, you know, in my vein. I'm a professor at Kutztown University, as I see folks that are joining know very well. And I have just great concerns about this. And for me, what we're seeing right now in terms of kind of state and global politics and the global pandemic is really kind of condensed in this question of going back to school in the midst of the pandemic, right? And I'm in this kind of dual place too as well. One, as a parent, I have two young kids. I have an 11-year-old son who is getting ready to go to middle school. This is his transition to middle school in the fall. My daughter is going into fourth grade. And I teach at Kutztown University, you know, and so we all experienced the absolute disruption that was caused by COVID-19 in the spring. And now as the push is to kind of reopen the schools in the fall, I'll tell you, it's pretty crazy. The kind of discussions that are happening at my university, happening other universities across the country, or they're happening in our local school districts. Not just my school district, but in different districts across the state of Pennsylvania, and you know, across the country for that matter. These kind of discussions are deeply problematic, and they can have long-term consequences for not just say public education, but our freaking communities, right? I mean, the COVID-19 pandemic, I mean, the virus is running rampant through our communities. Thank God here in Pennsylvania, we've had, you know, Governor Wolf has, you've heard, if you've listened to our regular podcast, you know that we have been critical of him when appropriate. We were a bit frustrated with what we saw as a slow rollout of the initial guidelines and then some hemming and hawing over it. But frankly, his administration has done a pretty damn good job, if you ask me, in keeping this outbreak at bay to the point where, you know, we're back in this kind of reopening phase. Now, the problem with the reopening phase, of course, is that when anytime you rely, this is kind of how I see the world on these things. Anytime you rely upon some sort of color coding of crisis, right? So red, yellow, green is what you're using. And we know those colors come from traffic lights, right? Red means stop, yellow means caution, and green means go, right? And that was the problem from the get-go in my mind, right? The problem from the get-go with this color coding thing is that people generally don't pay very close attention to the specifics of policy and politics, right? And that's always the challenge of those of us who are, say, politically involved. It's always the challenge of people who say, whether you're running for office, whether you're doing media commentary, whether you're doing political education, whatever it might be, is that kind of not, number one, getting too far out ahead of your base, right? And number two, not allowing you to kind of get taken over by this bubble of with other people that are also involved in politics, to forget that, like, lots of folks, not because they're bad people, right? But lots of folks are, you know, primarily focused on what's going on in their lives, right? So they're not, when they see green, right? Green to most people means go. It doesn't mean, well, listen, you can still begin to open up in a limited fashion as long as you adhere by these particular guidelines and so on. Right. It means go. Right. And then on top of that, we've got like the lunatic fringe in the state of Pennsylvania and across this country. Right. Headed by the kind of, you know, Cheeto in chief, right. At the, you know, the president of the United States, who are just in kind of full on denial mode, are in full on, you know, conspiracy mode, which has absolutely nothing to do with keeping people safe or having some sort of rational plan to making sure that we can do the things that we want to do, right? I look at, let's say this from the get-go. One of the things that is really clear to me is that most people want their kids back in school in the fall, right? When I'm talking to my neighbors, when I'm talking to people I know, most people, like, you know, question number one, would you like your kids to get back in school? Absolutely. I would like my kids to get back in school, right? Not because, like, I just, you know, want to force them out of my house, but because I think it's absolutely important, especially for younger kids, for the socialization kind of aspect of schooling, yes, and the academics and so on. But especially, I find, especially in that kind of that socialization environment, right, that's in a context of learning, right? You know, I grew up in a family of teachers, and school has always been kind of like a second home to me. So again, that separates me already from a bunch of other folks who've never felt that way. But so for me, you know, when I was growing up, for example, and right, my parents were going through a divorce and things like this, and I have a sister who's mentally handicapped, and that was going on all at the same time. School for me was a place to go where there was, you know, a context and a sense of possibility where I could, you know, kind of invest and learn and grow in ways that, you know, were sometimes difficult, like in my home life, right? So that goes through my mind when I'm thinking about my kids going back to school and connecting with their friends, connecting with their family, or connecting with their teachers, and then learning stuff that is beyond what I could teach them, right? And that's the kind of thing that, you know, I think most parents want, right? To get them to school for those reasons. Now, of course, there's a second reason there, right? And also it has to do with the conflict between kids at home and actually demands to be at work, right? Now, if we lived in any kind of sane and rational country where the way that you approach and respond to the COVID-19 or any pandemic for that matter would be to make sure that people had the resources which they weren't put into crisis by staying home from work, that would be one thing. But we obviously do not live in that kind of country. The kind of country that we live in is the kind of country that basically says, you know, okay, yeah, we can do that for a little bit, but then after that, you're on your own, right? And I don't need to tell you that we're in a situation where, you know, we don't have universal healthcare. We don't have universal childcare. We are not in a situation where many people can actually stay home from work without facing dire consequences. And we're seeing this all throughout the South right now, of course, right? As we see kind of, you know, Florida, for example, the cases in Florida, I'll admit, I didn't look today, but the cases in Florida have outpaced most other countries, right? Just the state of Florida. And as people get forced back to work and the schools are still closed, where do those kids go? Right. And this is that third level. So on the one hand, you've got kids in the school. Second part, you've got, you know, parents need to kind of have a place for their kids to go that is safe, like because they have to be at work and we don't have the kind of infrastructure in order to support that. So what do they do if daycares are closed? Right. We're going to see de facto daycares, right? Whether it's members of the community, whether it's going to be grandparents, whether it's going to be, you know, the neighbor down the street who happens to be home that the multiple kids can congregate out throughout the day, right? And that raises that third problem of the potential for community spread. Because now suddenly you're putting those kids together. And yes, the research is showing the younger kids especially, right? They're finding it, they're less likely to contract the virus and they're less likely to even spread it at the younger age. Does that mean that can't happen? No, it does not, right? I don't live in the on off black, white, either or world, right? Just like most of the world doesn't work that way, you know? In our case, we're in a situation where we've got to figure that out. I mean, we've got to figure out what are you going to do with the kids? Right. And if it's the person down the street, right, and say that person is in their 50s or their 60s, right, and they're watching those kids, that person is more susceptible. And every person that person comes in contact is going to be more susceptible. Right. And we don't have even the mechanisms to track that, right, in terms of community transfer, right, and the tracing of the virus. That's just not a possibility at this point. So all those questions are in my mind. Now, look, I'm also at the State System of Higher Education. I teach at Kutztown University. And if you know anything about me or if you listen to any of our shows before, you know that I don't trust a word that comes out of the mouth of our administration. And that's not just because I'm a distrustful person, although that's true. But it has to do with years and years of attempting to work with our administration in order to have some sort of sane and rational discussion about how to proceed in whatever the question is, whether it's the, you know, a quote unquote budget crisis, whether it's, you know, dealing with buildings that are unhealthy, whether it's dealing with the lack of psychological services for students at our universities, whether it's to dealing with, you know, the lack of access to buildings that are not ADA compliant, right? I mean, the list goes on and on. And I can't even tell you the number of times that, you know, I used to be the vice president of our local union. I was on our meet and discuss team for years. And a meet and discuss team is basically where you as the faculty and representatives of the faculty union meet with the administration to kind of hammer things out, right? You know, to kind of think about problems that arise that are not like clear cut in terms of the contract. You're trying to work something out. You're raising problems that need to be addressed, right? And that works both ways. And I can't tell you the number of times that we'd go to those meetings and we'd pose questions, which were, you know, there's mold growing on a building, for example, right? The building I work in was like saturated with black mold, right? From the moment I started working there in 2002. And it took about five years maybe, in order to get that administration at that time, it was a previous president, to recognize that there was a problem and then actually take steps for remediation, right? And those steps were things like giant dehumidifiers. They didn't deal with the problems with the circulation in the building. They didn't deal with a whole bunch of other stuff. They finally dealt with the HVAC system, what, last year, 2 years ago? Right? 16 years later? Here's another story. So again, if you listen to our podcast, you've heard me talk about this on our podcast before. There was a situation, I think it was the second or third week of school, right? Beginning of the fall semester. And there was a faculty member, there was an adjunct faculty member, right? Adjunct faculty, right? Again, the most precarious of all faculty at the university. They found out, this faculty member found out that they had a life-threatening medical condition. And if they did not get surgery, they would die. Okay, so, I mean, if you're that person, the choices are pretty clear-cut at that point. Right. This person went forward and spoke to the administration and basically said, okay, listen, as my doctor said, I have to take a leave of absence. I have to begin my, I have to go into the surgery. I think it was like in a week or 2 weeks, like pretty like immediate. They had to be in the surgery and they had to do some preparation and tests and all this kind of stuff that, you go into with any kind of surgery. And they said, okay, but then they say, I need a certain period of recuperation. Right. So I need to take medical leave for that period of the semester. Right. The problem was, is that that person did not have enough sick leave accrued because they're an adjunct faculty member. They didn't have enough sick leave to cover the entire semester. Right. And so then they were saying, well, if you don't come back, you're going to lose your job, basically. And this person's like, what am I going to do? And they were told, well, if you're not going to be back and we can't guarantee that you're going to have, someone come back, then we're basically going to fire you for the semester, right? We're just going to relieve you. And what that does in our culture, in our country, is that means that suddenly that person's health insurance is gone. Right before this person has to go to do life-saving surgery, right? And so there you have it. And we were like, from the union's perspective, we were like, hey, we've got to make sure that this person is taken care of. And they were like, nope, can't do it. Faculty got together and basically said, listen, we'll donate our sick time. We'll cover their classes. People in this person's department were ready to cover their classes to ensure that they could get the surgery and keep their position so they could have their health care. The administration, no. So Amanda Morris was our faculty our union president at the time, local union president. So she basically started this initiative that we raised the money on our own, right, through faculty donations to make sure that that person had their healthcare coverage, right? But so they lost their job and we had to cover their healthcare coverage, right? We pay that out to make sure that they weren't now going to be thrown out of their home and they'll still make rent. But that was the situation. The administration would not even work with us in order to make sure that that person was protected. Right? That just, I could tell you a dozen and a half questions or stories like this, where we have had an administration that has acted in so many ways without conscience, right? And their only perspective has been the bottom line. So now we're faced with a situation where the state system has like had to give students a bunch of reimbursements because obviously they weren't in their housing last year. Now, Kutztown University is crying budget crisis all over again, like it does every single time that, you ask anything of them. And they put out a plan for the return in the fall, which basically reads like a public relations document, right? There's no specifics in it. They're saying that we're going to adhere to particular guidelines. They're saying that we're going to adhere to the CDC guidelines and state mandates, but they don't tell you how. They say that they're going to be kind of having social distancing and they're going to encourage that through signage that will be posted all over the university. Signage. Well, what happens if people don't obey the signage? Well, personal responsibility, right? And if you read carefully, you read this document carefully, you can see that the primary goal of their document is to ensure that they do not face liability. That they are putting the responsibility onto faculty, washing their hands and ensuring social distancing. But if you ask them and say, okay, well, are you going to have temperature checks as people walk into buildings? Oh, no, we can't do that. That would cost too much. Right? That would cost too much. Yet, they have the money to spend on these little technological marvels called owls. Right? They look like little freaking owls. If you ever watched, like, way back in the day, I'm dating myself here too. I totally know, like, Clash of the Titans, like the, you know, the original one that had kind of like stop motion stuff within it. There was a robot owl in that. Right? They look kind of like that, except more sleek because, you know, we're 21st century now and all. And they sit in your classroom, right? And as you're talking, they're recording you and they're transmitting it to Zoom or whatever platform you're using, right? So that students who are not in the classroom can watch you. Right. So it's a live broadcast. Who owns that live broadcast? What are the terms of that? I haven't seen details on that, but put that aside. As you walk around the room, it tracks you. Right. So it follows you. And then if a student off to the side raises their hands and they start talking, it goes to split screen. So you get you and the person asking the question. Right. Now, frankly, just at a technological perspective, the things I'll admit it. Right. I can be a bit of a tech geek at times. They're freaking cool. Right. They're really cool. I mean, it shows you the kind of advances in some of this technology, right? There's that going on. But they're like at least $1,000 a pop, right, for every classroom. So they don't have money to devote to temperature checks, but for technology. And this has been what we're seeing across higher education and K through 12, for that matter. K through 12, you have some limits on this, but not extensively. And higher ed is you look for ways that you can replace faculty members, replace staff with technology, right? They're not willing to spend the money on people. They're willing to spend the money on technology because that fits nicely in a PR pamphlet. They can show what they're doing. They can take cool pictures of those things. There's not something exciting in their mind of having qualified faculty member, qualified staff, right, to do the jobs that need to be done. The other thing that's glowingly absent, I guess, from the Kutztown University's back to school plan is the concern about staff and faculty. Right? I mean, when you tell, for example, there's this part of the document. I wasn't going to do this, but if I can find it, I will pull it out. They are asking students at Kutztown University, for example, to come up with a plan, right? They're going to come up with their COVID plan, right? It's pretty cool, right? So they're going to come up with the COVID plan, and they're not going to have to submit it anywhere. They just have to have the plan and check a box somewhere that says they have one. And somehow that's it, that they got to abide by it. So what happens if you have students? Now, look, I'll say the vast majority of students that I teach at Kutztown University, right, are really responsible individuals, right? They're responsible, they're caring, they're considerate, they're good people, right? But not everybody is. Just like there's no place where everybody's perfect and is going to follow all these things. So that's the concern. And then what happens on the Friday night? Not week one, maybe not week two, but as you got into it, the semester starts rolling on. What happens when those students start to go party? They're not sick. They're not feeling bad. Sure, I'll go out. And then they're back in the classroom. The students, now there's new research that's coming out, of course, that is showing that even those students that are, or people in that age group, I shouldn't just say students, people in that age group, right? From 18, say, to 24 or so, right? As your kind of main wheelhouse of students that are there, that they're less susceptible to get it than older adults. People like me, but there's more cases of that creeping up, right? We saw that especially happening in the follow-up to after Memorial Day, when there was the openings that were taking place in, you know, in Oklahoma and Texas and across the South. There's some of the stories that come out of Arizona, that come out of Texas are heartbreaking about students who have been on ventilators now for weeks. They thought they were immune. They thought they were invincible to the virus. They didn't worry about that, right? We also don't really live in a culture of personal responsibility. We live in a culture of, you know, I'm looking out for me. And if I'm not worried, why should I have to wear a mask? Right? Right? That's it, right? I mean, you know, I've got these masks. I listen to this podcast called The Majority Report. They've got this this great mask. They took a slogan that the Czech Republic was using. It says, "My mask protects you, your mask protects me." Printed right on the mask, right? And that's the whole idea, right? Is that if we lived in a culture that valued community first, right, that kind of respected each other, then we would live more in a culture, right, that this mask wearing wouldn't be such a problem. Because, of course, you wouldn't want to infect someone else. That would be horrifying. But that's not where we live. We live in the people that can only think about themselves. Masks, I'm not sick. What do I have to worry about? Or I'm young. I can't catch it. What other people? Right? And that's the big concerns, right? The big concerns of this whole process is you have students that are going to come back. They're going to be in classrooms. And I even think about things like this. Well, what about in between classes? Right? In between classes, when you've got 2 or 3, 4, 5, 10, 12, 20 classes changing at the same time, all those students file out into the hallways at the same time. Most of the buildings that I've been on my campus, there is no way that those students could maintain proper social distancing. No way. Just the physical space itself is not conducive of that. And then when they go to the stairwells to get downstairs from the second floor in my building, that's even worse. And then you're having faculty and staff that are kind of moving through that. So that's one. I mean, just at the very baseline of like, what are the points of protection? What are the kinds of things that the university is willing to do? And again, it's all about PR. It's nothing about kind of actually spending money or being proactive and ensuring that things are done. There was a study that came out from our union. Mike Gambone, he's a member of our union. He got a team of folks and they went around and they kind of like did a whole bunch of research about what were going to be best practices for higher education and returning to campus in the fall. And guess what? When they found out that those best practices were good, basically, here are all the things that you would need to do in order to ensure social distancing in the classroom, right? And it became pretty clear that there was no way that our university was going to spend the kind of money that they would need to do, right? So, for example, there's about, and don't quote me on this number, but this is kind of what I'm bringing this from memory, but really the folks at, Ask Me, who's kind of the union that covers our clerical staff and our custodial staff, that those are the folks that have been cut. Those positions have been cut by about 30%, somewhere in there, right? I'm going to get just in the buildings, right? They've cut third shift, for example. That's 30% right there. Right, for cleaning. And you've had many custodial staff, they've been forced to kind of now just not just be responsible for one building, but responsible for multiple ones. Right? We've had complaints. We complain about this from faculty members, not to the, you know, to those workers, not their fault, but to our administration that, you know, because you've pulled all the custodial staff from our buildings, right? You've got garbage overflowing in the bathrooms all throughout the day. Right? You've got slippery floors that are not taken care of, right? Those custodial workers, right? They're an integral part of the safety of that building and they've been cut. And I know, because I've, you know, got my little birds, I'm going to go Game of Thrones here. My little birds tell me that basically the custodial staff has been encouraged informally, of course, not to worry so much about those guidelines, not to worry so much about the CDC guidelines. They're a little crazy. Right. I can also tell you, and if you've been following Raging Chicken Press for any length of time, you know about the history of the right wing zealots that run our facilities department at Kutztown University. They're big Trumpers, man. They don't believe the COVID's even real. So they're overseeing the custodial staff. You've got, and they report directly to administration and finance, right? So the guy, the guy who heads the facilities reports directly to administration and finance. Administration and finance is saying to them, hey, guess what? We got no money. So you're going to have to deal with this, right? And then the people who are, you know, ahead of the administration and ahead of the facilities are like, big Trumpers don't believe in COVID anyways. And they're being told just to cut their staff. Make their staff do things that are inappropriate. And I know also for a fact that there's real concerns among members of the custodial staff at Kutztown University that they do not have the right equipment and they are not going to be guaranteed the right protective equipment that they are going to need to keep themselves safe. Right? It's not just the students, folks. It's the students, it's the staff, it's the faculty, and it's the community in which all those people interact. Right? So you've got that. yet another thing that just took place. So at kind of earlier on in the summer, you had the clerical staff. We're told that each of the secretaries were going to get plexiglass dividers, right? They were going to sit on their desks or, depending on their configuration in their office space, they were going to get these plexiglass dividers. Now, anybody who's been grocery shopping knows what the hell I'm talking about, right? You've got plexiglass dividers that make sure that not just, right, are the people who are shopping at the grocery store safe from getting any germs from that person working, but the worker is protected from all those people coming in, bringing potential germs. Right? So really, those plexiglass things are absolutely essential for the workers. But once again, we live in a culture that doesn't value workers, doesn't value teachers, doesn't value clerical staff, doesn't value custodians. We're expendable because we don't fit into a nice PR document like the OWL technological wonder that will be in all of our classrooms. And so what happened? They're promised this. And then a couple weeks go by, a few weeks go by, nothing's happening. People began questions. Nope, they're not going to get them. Nope. You're not getting your plexiglass divider. Right? And once again, I'm going to give another shout out to my friend Mike Gambone. Right? Him and other faculty members have started raising some hell about it. And you know what he started doing? He started building the plexiglass divide for the Secretary of the History Department. And then writing about that and posting that to the faculty listserv and beyond. And to Facebook, let everybody know. And then guess what happens? Oh, and then the administration goes, oh my God, no. It was a miscommunication. I swear to God, we're going to get those. Right. And they sent out an email shortly after some of this stuff goes, starts getting some circulation and people are asking questions about it. You wonder who's asking the questions, right? Who is it that made that phone call? Because they sure as hell don't listen to us. They sure as hell don't listen to custodial staff. They sure as hell don't listen to ground staff. Right? Was it parents? Right? Was it people on their board of trustees? Was it Representative Judy Swank? Right? Represents that area? I don't know. But suddenly now there's an email from the director of facilities. No. We're going to do the plexiglass things. But here's the key. And anybody who ever's worked anywhere knows what this means. Right? It wasn't just that they were going to get like they were just going to do the plexiglass. No. Each individual secretary, right, administrative assistant, each one had to make a case, make an argument to their supervisor, right, that it was justified that they have this divider. So now suddenly they're in the position of having to be experts on social distancing and what it takes in order to ensure a safe workplace, right? That's what they got to do. And then their supervisor has to get approval from like vice president, someone on the freaking president's cabinet. And if you've worked anywhere, you know that that is a bunch of BS, that is a Byzantine process that is designed to get you to not get what you want. It's to dissuade you for asking from the plexiglass divider so it can be put on you in the end. You get sick, why didn't you ask for one? Right? That's the bullshit we have to deal with. That's the bullshit. And so, and then they come out and there's a union meeting and they're like, no, miscommunication. But you talk to the click, and again, it's just a freaking lie. So you're telling me that those clerical workers, right? Those secretaries, those administrative assistants, they were actually doing the work and were told that they couldn't have their plexiglass divider. They were just lying. It's a load of bullshit, right? They were not. They were told by someone above them, right? Maybe it was their supervisor who didn't feel like dealing with it, right? Maybe it was one of the Trumpers who run the freaking facilities crew at Kutztown University. The ones that I wrote about before exposed the whole abuse of workers. The ones that protect the abuse from administrators commit onto the workers and students for that matter. Yeah, this is just too much. So, it's funny. That's not funny. what ABSCUF is been pushing for, my faculty union, right? We had a survey that came out not too long ago. And the survey basically said that you could, how did you feel about coming back in the fall, right? And a bunch of other questions. And the results of this has been reported on in Penn Live. There was actually a really excellent show on WHYY, Radio Times, and Marty Moskowin that did COVID-19 in higher education. And in that show, they highlighted the ABSCUF survey too as well. And they found like 70% of faculty members were uneasy. That was the parlance they used. They were uneasy about returning to campus in the fall. Why were they uneasy? Because of the freaking virus, right? Not because of it. Did they want to be there? Absolutely. I, for one, can't stand most online education. It is not my thing, right? I think I can do it, and I think I can do it well. That doesn't mean I like doing it. That's not what I set out to do when I became a faculty member, when I entered academia. It's not it at all, right? So 70% of faculty. And you also had kind of a high percentage of faculty, about 40%, that said they had some sort of pre-existing condition, right? And they said, I can't remember the percentage of this one, but they said that they're concerned that students are not going to be social distancing outside of the classroom. And they're going to bring it in, which makes sense. So there we are. And so what ABSCUF has been put, look, we should be all online. Look, Westchester University, they saw the writing on the wall. They saw the cases starting to peak back up. We only have 6 weeks before the beginning of the semester. They saw the cases being starting to pick back up. And they're like, you know what? Instead of having to wait to the last minute and go into crisis mode where we're trying to suddenly switch everything out when students are already beginning to plan their move back in. No, that's it. We're in the fall semester is going to be all online. We're doing this all online. We're going to do this for safety. And from what I understand, at least, there was some degree of agreement across the board. Faculty, staff, administration, nope, got to do this. Not long after that, East Stroudsburg University was the next one, right? East Stroudsburg University, yep, we're doing like hybrid or kind of all online. Got to do it, right? For the health and safety of our students, of our staff, and our faculty. If you know anything about the administration of East Stroudsburg University too, that should be like, whoa, because you got good old Marcia up there who's a piece of work, let me tell you. Now, she's an outgoing president, so I think she's like, she's got no skin in the game anymore. But the guy who's coming in, Ken Long was like vice president of administration and finance, or assistant vice president of administration and finance at Kutztown, that went over to East Stroudsburg and was one of those folks that started carrying out some of the austerity measures that we saw at Kutztown and then at East Stroudsburg. So I know it's a tangent and aside, but they both did it, right? And Kutztown University is in the middle, right? And what's going on there? I don't know. And more faculty are beginning to make a push in order to go all online. I know that Shippensburg University, I see Steve Haas has kind of joined us, listening a little bit. Shippensburg University has got a petition out where they're asking people to kind of sign to say, nope, all online in the fall, right? I've been floating out that idea that, you know what, maybe as faculty, we should be in a situation in which we should say, look, we're not coming back. We're not coming back. All online or we're not coming back. Right? That's an absolute critical issue. Right? And I'm of the mind. This is, again, I'll give you another little tangent here. And then I kind of want to remind you. So before I go on my little tangent, is that one of the things. Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome, Steve. One of the things that you can do here on this podcast, you just saw Steve do this now, is that it should somewhere on your screen. Again, the arrangement is probably different depending on what your setup is, but you have the ability to kind of comment on this. You want to kind of post comments up there. You want to have questions, you want to post the comments, it's fine. You should also have, there's a little call button on the app and in the kind of platform if you're sitting at a computer, where you can actually kind of ask to call in. And what it'll do is it'll show up on my screen that you got guest and call in. I'll let you know that I see your call coming in. And, if I'm finishing up with something, then, I'll kind of like let you know, hey, okay, I see it. And we could come in. But I'd invite you to kind of, you've got ideas, you've got thoughts, you've got concerns, you got additions, you've got stories that you want to tell. I mean, really, this is what this space is about. And this is one of the reasons why I thought it was necessary that we went beyond just the weekly podcast and Out the Coop, but begin to kind of have a broader sense of engagement and allow us to have a different kind of conversation in this space. So anyways, my tangent was this, is that back in 2016, and let me put my cards on the table here. Long before, well, I should say about a year before 2016 hit, right? Way before the election, probably 2015, 2014, I was at the point where I was ready to leave Kutztown. And part of it would just had to be the incessant lack of coherency and transparency from our administration and our broader discussions. But it also had to do with, you know, some academic things. I saw programs that I was helping build fall apart and are part of the austerity measures and kind of the cutbacks and all this other kinds of stuff. And didn't really feel like I was able to do what I've been wanting to do, right? I really wanted to build things, not just, you know, be a cog in the machine of equipment. I want to be part of building a program and so on. And so I was fully prepared in 2016 to go on the job market, right? And, you know, my wife works in the area. She's not in a situation where she can just up and move very easily, as easily as me. So, you know, I recognize my prospects were limited, but there were about three jobs in the area that I thought I would have been a really good candidate for. But 2016 was also a contract negotiation year in our union. And it became pretty clear that we were in for a fight and we were going to start planning for do strike preparations. And I had done it before. So I was asked to kind of help out and be the kind of strike chair for the fall. And I was like, you know what? This is worth the fight to save public higher education, to save, you know, the whole mission of higher education, especially public higher education in the state of Pennsylvania. Right. We deal with, you know, first generation students, the working class students of this state go to our universities. And that's why I went there to begin with. I could have stayed at GW when I was at GW. I could have been paid more money. I would have had a lower teaching load, but I wanted to come to Kutztown to work with those students and because they had a union. So that's what I did. I called off my job search plans and went to work for the strike. And that strike in 2016 was one of the most important and I'd say glorious moments of my life, because it gave us a vision of what we could do, of working together, what was possible, the organization that could be possible, the kind of camaraderie, right? That it was not like professional courtesy, but was real discussion and a sense of shared mission. The discussions and the solidarity with students and the community was just amazing. It was beyond my wildest dream of success. And we won. We only had a strike for 3 days. The state system of higher education had no idea that we had that kind of power and we had that kind of willingness and we could able to marshal the kind of support that we did, because they think we don't matter to education. They think faculty don't matter to education. We are secondary in their minds, but for students, we're primary. And their parents know that. If you go to K through 12, that's like that to like 100 times the degree that we feel at higher education. A lot of folks don't like us in higher ed, but you know, we're always whipping. But if you're a K through 12, you ever taught K through 12, or if you're a K through 12 teacher now, you know that you have networks in the community, right? And those parents look to you. So anyways, we did that. And we came out of that strike feeling amazing. I think as a union, we saw our own power for the first time in history. ABSCUF had never been on a strike before. The fact that I could have been part of that is just incredible. The people that were on Mike Gambone, our picket chair, what he did was incredible. Colleen Fitzgerald, right? She was our office manager at the time. Without her, we would have had like a tenth of the imagination that we did had it not been for her. Our union president, Amanda Morris, never wavered, got behind the organ. I mean, all that stuff, right? And within a short period of time after that victory, right? It was on October 19th. My birthday is when we went on strike, my birthday, best birthday present I ever had. We went out on strike on my birthday in October. And by the end of that semester, we started getting messages back from our statewide leadership that says, you know what? Just go back. We got this from here. And, you know, a lot of us were like, wait, we're not done. We have to build now. We have to organize more. The organizer, the statewide organizer that we had, we thought that we should have more organizers. But we had part of our union leadership thought that no more. And the guy who was doing the organizing at the time, they thought, too much of a problem. This guy wants to organize too much. We got to get rid of him. So he finally got the message and got a different job, left. And the organizing, you know, it starts and stopped, but kept on getting the messages. No. We're just going to go back to our insider business unionism. And that's where we go. And we squandered the opportunity to build on that power. And so 2 years later, 3 years later, we see what teachers have been doing all over this country. Like K-12 teachers are always, always at the forefront. Higher ed faculty are very often, unless you're an adjunct, right? If you're an adjunct union, you're building adjunct union. Higher education faculty and teachers, they can be tough. K-12 teachers get it, right? Because they're daily in their classrooms with lack of resources, overcrowded classrooms, right? They feel directly the cuts of funding. And they deal with all sorts of social problems that they're asked to kind of manage, which is not really their job. But nonetheless, we look to them. And so when we saw the uprisings in Kentucky, when we saw the Ed for Red movement, we saw the Wildcat strikes, when we saw those strikes over there, those K-12 teachers are leading the way. And once again, right now, they're doing the same thing. And we saw protests in Missouri, like across the South, Arizona, Texas, right? We saw this in the Northeast. We saw this protest by those K-12 teachers who basically say, no, we are not going back. Not because we don't want to be teaching. We miss our students like crazy, but we're not going back into a meat grinder. You want us back? You put the damn resources into that building. You hire extra custodial staff. You expand the number of teachers that we have in order to meet the demand that we need. Now, that should be happening generally, but at the very least, in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of a crisis, we can do that. We are choosing not to. Right, I just read this article Sunday, is in the I'm going to forget the Intelligencer. It's a Bucks County Intelligencer, and talk about Bucks County schools, right? And they are saying up front, they will not be social distancing of 6 feet. They say 6 feet when practical, but it's not going to be practical. So 3 feet. 3 feet. 3 feet is not a scientific number. It's a body's number. It's what can we actually fit in here? It's a fire code number. And that's what's making decisions, because they can't think outside of, you know, the austerity mentality that we've all been trapped in for so long. And so now this is what we're going to be. We're going back in a situation. They're telling us, it was in the papers. Hey, here it is. Here's our guidelines. Our guidelines say 6 feet when possible, but we know it's not possible. So therefore not. Right. And this is Bucks County. Right. Most schools in Bucks County are not hurting. Most, not all, but quite a few of them are not hurting the way that lots of other schools are. And they're telling you, yeah, sorry, no social distancing here. Can't do it. It's too much work. Right. And I'll tell you, the people, I'm in the Penn Ridge School District. The administration of Penn Ridge schools, and especially in my kids' elementary school, have been fantastic, right? And in terms of communication, in terms of bringing things forward. And I fully recognize the bind that so many of these folks are in. Let me be clear about that. I can't even imagine the number of sleepless nights that these people have when they have to kind of be making these kind of decisions, when they're being told by legislators out in Harrisburg, and by the federal government that, no, sorry, we're not going to help you with any resources. And they're trying to do their best. But man, I'll tell you, I do not envy them. So this is where we are. I don't know. So, you know, one of the things that, If anybody's got something to say, if anybody wants to jump in, you want to kind of try out the little call-in feature, feel free. I'd love to hear from you. Love to hear your thoughts. Just click on that kind of, I think it's a little phone icon or something like this, and you'll pop up in here. I'd love to hear from you if you want to jump in. Otherwise, so let me kind of step back a little bit and tell you a little about what we're hoping to do here on basically a weekly basis. So this week, I'm calling this a pre-launch. In part, I'm calling this a pre-launch because I basically want to work the kinks out, right, before we do kind of a full-on promotion of this. We've been building this for some time. And frankly, from my perspective, I need this for my own sanity, right? I need to be in a situation where I can have a conversation with people and connect with people over some of these issues. Right. And I'm sure, look, there's going to be times that there's going to be some assholes that are going to be calling in on the show and, you know, whatever. So bring them on. Right. You know, especially once we go live. That's the other reason why we're doing some pre-shows ahead of time. So just to see if we can make it work. I've had to master this. One of the things I've been doing since the end of the spring is trying to figure out how to use this. The studio, it's called Open Broadcasting Software. OBS, which allows you to kind of stream stuff directly to, say, YouTube, right? So if you got kids, you're out there, they're watching streamers and things like this, a lot of them use OBS. So I've learned that. So actually, technically right now, like if you went to our YouTube page, right, you just went to YouTube, put in Raging Chicken, and you kind of look for the one with, I don't know how many subscribers is on it. Can't see it there. But you'll see it streaming right now. You'll actually see the video, right? See my ugly little face. And you also see me like giving you a cheers right now for showing up tonight. This is not actually an official sponsorship. So I just want to be clear, but I am drinking a New Trail Brewing heliocentric ale. It's a tart ale. Which is really good. New Trail has been one of my new faves lately. I've been in love exploring some of their stuff. So I just found out I got some stuff coming from Levante Brewing this week too as well. So the reason I'm bringing that up too as well is on Out to Coop podcast every Friday. For those of you who may not have listened to us before, for Out to Coop, we got, you know, we do kind of state politics, we do national politics, and then we have a section called Last Call where we do space news and we talk about different kinds of beer that's out. I'm always highlighting Free Will Brewing because that's where, you know, brews right here where I live in Perkasie. And then we come up with new ones like New Trail, which I've been exploring. We talk a little about those, give you some suggestions. And I got some stuff coming in from Levante Brewing down in Westchester too as well, which we'll be talking about on the show on Friday too as well. The other thing, Sean and I have been kind of talking, kind of offering up some of the things we've been watching and streaming too as well. If you're looking for new stuff to watch, it's one of the features we do on a regular podcast. But this really here, Out to Coop Live is meant to be a place where we're going to interact. And I was very excited when Podbean launched this live service, right? That allowed you to kind of stream in this way, allows you to take calls and comments and kind of engage with your audience. I was very pleased by that. I was very excited about it. And, you know, it took no time to actually test it. I actually had some great people from the Podbean community, from the podcasting community that are based on Podbean, be willing to kind of jump on when I did some random public show just to try to figure it out. And they kind of helped me through some of the effects of it. And so here we are. We're sitting here with the ability to do this every week. And what I hope to do in this is, in addition to, you know, talking about issues that are coming up as they face them, to have bring some guests on the show, to kind of do kind of interview-esque kind of thing. What's really nice is, what's been one of my frustrations about the regular podcast that we do on Fridays is that while Sean and I are kind of, you know, able to kind of talk, and I much prefer that environment where you kind of have some kind of engagement, interaction. But when Sean and I are able to kind of like talk back and forth, we can't take calls, right? There's a way we can do it now, in part because we've been using Zoom. The way we used to do it before through Google Hangouts, they kind of got rid of their older service and we did a YouTube live thing and they changed that up and that all kind of went to pot. So we're doing it through Zoom. And we could bring more people on Zoom. It just messes some of the things up with our streaming. So especially with OBS, I'm having to kind of reconfigure the screens, but I think I'm pretty sure I know how to do it. It's just we'll have to have a special screen for it and things like this. But this, right, having an all audio one, would be really useful. So right now I'm getting a call in here from Steve Haas. So we're going to give this a whirl. Let's see. Steve, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Kevin. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing really well. I actually had to find my earbuds to make the call, but I'm glad I was able to do it while you were still on. So thank you for doing what you're doing. And, you know, I totally hear what you're saying, especially about the letdown after the successful strike and, you know, how organizing, you know, didn't continue after that point. And, you know, a number of us have been kind of working towards that. You've probably seen some of the activity through labor notes that a number of us are trying to do. We sort of have like weekly calls with this public higher education group that's called FEW.
Yep.
And so, yeah, one of the things that kind of spun off of that is, you know, speaking of what's happening now and you know, all the, a number of us wanting to go online, like Westchester and East Stroudsburg, is a petition that Shippensburg sort of started. A few of us, you know, got working on that. And it was interesting that Seth, who's the statewide mobilization chair, you know, kind of supported it and talked about, you know, the general APSCEF petition and had mentioned how, you know, we're doing some different things here. You know, APSCEF is working behind the scenes and trying to push PASHE. But, you know, he sort of admired what we were doing as a grassroots effort. So I just kind of wanted to mention that and, you know, hope for support on that as we try to get more signatures on that petition. So
absolutely. Now, do you have a link for that?
I can try to send it to you here during the call, or I can definitely get it to you afterward.
Yeah, if you put it, I would do both. If you could drop it right here in the notes, that'd be awesome, because I would ask other people to take that link and share it if you can. And then what I can also do is that we're basically going to take this, the recording of this show today, and this will be kind of brought into our main podcast feed too as well. And so I'll put that in the show notes to make sure there's a direct link to that petition.
That's great. I am going to see if I can copy that right now. Sometimes a little bit of a Luddite with technology,
but that's all right. So let me ask you this, Steve, while you're dealing with your Luddite challenge. So, I mean, what's been the talk at Shippensburg? I mean, are people as concerned as it seems to be? I know a lot of faculty are at Kutztown. What's that situation look like?
Well, it's been a challenge. I mean, I think a lot of our faculty, I don't know what the issue is, whether it's contentment or fear. We've been talking about this in terms of trying to get more people to do some bottom-up organizing. I mean, you know, it's a lot of it's been Jerry Carbo. I'm sure he wouldn't mind me giving him a shout out, because he's the one that really kind of motivates a lot of it. But it's been difficult to get, you know, more of a consistent, coherent group working together. But, you know, we're just forging ahead, you know, like the comic says, keep trucking, you know.
Yeah, right.
Keep rolling on. So let me see if I got the petition here. I think I sent it through. I sent you the right link.
It's there. It came right up
it's a Google form. So
Yep. I'll take that and I will drop that directly into the show notes for today's show. That's awesome.
That's super appreciated.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that, you know, we've been doing locally at Kutztown too, we started this group. It was just starting to ramp up in the spring before we actually got the full shutdown, is working with this group that we started, just called the Healthy Campus Bill of Rights. And the whole idea was, you know, there've been so many of us have been fighting on so many different kind of levels or angles, I guess, and essentially the same problem, right, is about the lack of administrative responsiveness to a range of problems. And that ranged from, you know, unhealthy buildings, to lack of access to psychological services for students, to like overt institutional racism, right? To sexual exploitation and kind of sexual harassment. I mean, right across the board, right? So you have all these, you know, students and faculty and staff members at different, and you know how we all are, right? We're all kind of, we're not in one space working necessarily on the same problem. We're all trying to address it through the avenues that we have and, you know, to more or lesser degree of success along the way. And it kind of occurred to us all the things, well, you know what? Maybe we should be talking to each other, right? And we got some help, you know, so just, you know, this a couple of organizers that I know are willing to kind of help guide us a little bit. And through those discussions, we said, you know what? If we think about the problem of like just health and safety, right? Access to psychological care and making sure that our buildings are safe and our classrooms are safe and all that kind of stuff, safe and healthy. And if we think about like a healthy environment for learning and being and living, so like free of racism and exploitation and harassment, right? I mean, and then we thought about the climate change, right? Talk about climate change and the fact that everything that we do exists like under that time frame, right? So that what is our university was in like a non-actor when it came to actually making plans, right? To kind of go to kind of zero carbon emissions, right? And so, you know, it's like, and we got the talk, say that's why we put the Healthy Campus Bill of Rights to begin thinking about pushing an agenda, right? And I know that the group is still organizing and I've been on calls with them like over the summer. But you know, it was one of those kind of things that we had a town hall right before spring break, right before we had the shutdown, and the stories that we heard from students and staff were just unbelievable about what they had faced. Right. And, you know, we had the momentum and then here we go, we got COVID-19. And so having to kind of, you know, having organization thrown up into bus. And I think that, you know, part of what you're talking about, the difficulties, I think that there is a real difficulty from people just being able to just, you know, recoup from having to turn their lives upside down.
Yeah, you know, and we don't hear, you know, we don't hear a lot from people because we've been kind of, you know, disconnected. So there's so much stuff, I think, going on in the background that we're not even individually as faculty members aware of.
Right, right. No, man. Well, hey, thank you for all you're doing. And I'm so glad, you know, I've seen the petition. I don't know if I've signed it yet, but if I haven't yet, I will. And I know that Seth Kahn gave you guys a shout out too as well. And Seth put out, he had an article that came out this week. He posted up on Facebook on his blog, really Here Comes too. Trouble.
Yep.
And again, talking about need for this. I floated this idea on Facebook, you know, look, I mean, we should really be thinking about making them look, we don't get tangible specifics about keeping our administration or keeping our buildings at our universities safe for everybody back.
Like you guys did with the mold. I mean, that was a great example of how you could sort of run a campaign.
Yeah, no, exactly. But yeah, thank you so much. So anything else on your mind?
No. I mean, I appreciate it. If you could share our petition, I mean, you're very well connected, so that might help boost our signature number. You know, we're trying to get it up, you know, close to 300, I think, before we, you know, sort of present it to the administration or whomever we're going to present it to. But yeah, it's been a slow burn. We're trying to just, build up the signatures and, you know, reach out to our social network. So thanks again.
You got it. No, and I appreciate you kind of taking a minute to call in. It's like, it's always much better to have somebody to talk to than talking to yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I look forward to the day again when we can, meet somewhere and talk about this stuff in person.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
A bunch of other folks as well. So thanks again, Kevin, for everything you're doing. It's awesome.
Hey, you got it, man. Thanks so much.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Well, I'm looking at the clock right now, everybody. It's about 5 after 8, right? 4 after 8, something in that neighborhood. And I'm going to try to keep these to about an hour on Mondays. Hopefully the Monday at 7 o'clock time will work out well. It happens to work out well for me, which is why I'm hoping it'll work out, because I have my kids all day. My wife works late on Mondays, so I can get my kids situated and just come down here, knock this podcast out, and see what we can do. So I appreciate y'all from tuning in. I want to give a super, super special shout out at this moment to Jonathan Mann. Jonathan Mann is the guy who holds the Guinness Book of World Records for writing the most songs, consecutive songs every day, right? So he holds a world record, a song a day guy, right? So Jonathan Mann, you know, I can't remember how I came across him, right? And apparently I was definitely late to the game in some things, but if you go to jonathanmann.net, you get a link to all his stuff. Check him out on YouTube. And he just does some really cool stuff. And then I found out he's from New Jersey, which is like, I'm like, that's, he's freaking the state next door is even better. And then my friend, Brett is actually, he knows him too as well. Somehow. So it's just kind of all around. Anyways, the song you heard for the intro and the song that you're going to hear going out today is from Jonathan Mann. I contacted him, you know, again, this is, I love this song, but wanted to use it for a while, but you know, I hadn't thought about it for tonight, but then it's like, you know what, that would really be the perfect, the intro for this. And I, you know, just message him on Twitter tonight, or this afternoon actually, and said, hey, listen, he let me use one of his songs for one of the podcasts one day. He's got this great song. It's called like Mint the $2 trillion Coins, right? That's how I first came across him. But anyways, Jonathan's, you know, replied almost immediately and said, oh my God, you could totally use my song. That's fine. It's great. That's awesome. So huge shout out to him. Want you encouraged to go to jonathanmann.net and check out all those things. Check him out on YouTube. Check him out on Twitter. Let me see if you can follow him on Twitter. Let me get that for you real fast. If I can get it here. Oh my God. I can't stand when I do this. I had his Twitter up and then, let me see right now. Hang on there. I swear we're going to get there. Well, I'll have to put it in the show notes because I'm not. I'm just going to my messages. Here you go. Okay. So basically, you're going to go. You can follow him at Song A Day Man. That's at Song A Day Man with two N's. Song A Day Man. It's Jonathan Mann. Please follow him on Twitter. Give him some love. Tell him that you heard his stuff. You heard his music tonight. His song called No People in the World. It's just like, I absolutely love the song and it seemed to be perfect, especially in this time when we're trying to find ways of connecting. And oftentimes it can feel like we're out there by ourselves. And so, at a time when movements are building, where young people across this country and world, thank God, are taking control of the movements and are pushing us directions that has the potential to save us all. The song still resonated with, good old Gen Xer right here. So anyways, want a special thanks to Jonathan Mann. Again, follow him on Song A Day Man on Twitter. Check him out on YouTube and you can go to his webpage at jonathanmann.net for links to all his stuff and songs about his stuff. So great guy, great songs, ranging from the absolute hilarious to the kind of the politically astute. So go check him out. Anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I want to thank you all for tuning in. I hope this all goes well on the live stream too as well. So patrons of our show, right? If you are a patron of Raging Chicken, you go to patreon.com/RC Press and become a patron for as little as $5 a month. You will have access to the video recording of this today. This is technically streaming right now, but it's not open to the public. We're going to send that link and that's going to be a patrons only one. Eventually, once we get the kinks worked out and everything like this, it will be available to everybody. But our patrons always get first crack and give us feedback and seeing how things look so that, you know, it's a little bit behind the scenes. So there you go. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Thank you all for tuning in. I especially appreciate the folks that stepped on. Thank you to Steve for calling in today. And next week, look forward to having some more folks, hopefully. The other thing I want to give you a shout out to, I'm looking to get a guy. We might have a show on Wednesday. I'm not quite sure. If we listen to our regular podcast, you may have heard me talk about this. But I'm looking to bring on someone from Kutztown University campus who's done some computer modeling about the spread of the COVID-19 virus on campus who bring all the students back. Hoping to have him in to talk about us. He did a really cool video on that too as well. But I'll keep you posted on that. Don't forget to like us. Don't forget to follow us. And please share. We want to get this word out to as many folks. We want to build out this community. The last bit of news I have, we got great news today that we got the officially Podbean started releasing buttons or badges that for, you know, kind of awards. We got our 10,000 downloads awards today. Technically, to be honest, we're actually at about 24,000 downloads, but they just released the badge. So we, boom, once they released them, they gave us that first badge. I was so psyched. I posted that out. I'd like you to help me and help us get this podcast to the next level, which is 50,000 likes. We got our 50,000 downloads. So you make sure that you're subscribing to this, you're downloading it. Even if you can't listen to every single episode, get out there and download it. Rate us on iTunes, rate us on Podbean, rate us where you can do, give us comments and share it with your friends. And that will help us get us to that next level of 50,000 downloads and get that next badge. That would be such an awesome day. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Once again, shout out to Jonathan Mann, and this is from him. There are no people in the world. We'll see you next week. And don't forget to tune in on Friday for Out to Coop Podcast with Sean Kitchen. Talk to you later. Cheers.
Is there anybody there? It seems I'm all alone again. Does anybody care? This planet's empty. I see no signs of life. Please don't tell me that the human race did not survive.
There are no people in the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call. I guess I'll fly.